sent home. And what'll I do, you know, because we hadn't really discussed, or I think Mum had made preparations, but it certainly hadn't gone through me because I was still expecting that I'd be there. Anyway, so Barbara was casting these eyes around the crowd, and I was trying to sort of shrivel into the wooden seat and, you know, hide in the dirt on the floor and all the rest. And I said, I don't know. And Barbara gave me this funny look, you know, and I found out later what that funny look was all about. But he just let that go. And then I felt miserable. I felt that I should have had the guts to get out there with my brothers and say no, because I knew that that's what I really felt. So anyway, he left me feeling totally gutless, as well as all the other things I was feeling by that stage. And the next day, actually, he came back to it. When we had the personal interviews, he asked me again, would I obey him? And I'd really cogitated about this all night. In fact, what Mum was saying before about the sleeping during the night was very interesting. I couldn't sleep because I was just in terrible turmoil about this question of obedience. And I asked everyone there. I asked Francis, I asked my father, I asked, you know, everyone but the dog, I think, about what obedience meant. And they all had different versions, but what they all added up to the same thing. I knew I damn well couldn't do it. So I thought to myself, right, I've never felt so miserable before in my whole life. And I got up out of bed because I wanted to go to the loo, which was way down Whoop Whoop. It's another story about the facilities there. But anyway, so I came back and I could see the lights still on in Barbara's room and everybody else was sound asleep. There wasn't a thing stirring. And I felt quite alone just for that thing. You know, here's me with this dreadful problem, and it obviously wasn't a problem to other people, so what's wrong with me? And just then the dog, this dog Prince that had just rolled up out of nowhere, came and put its snout in my hand as though, and it was consoling me. And then I thought then, well, perhaps things aren't so bad, you know, that if a dog can come up and console me, well, at least there's somebody around who knows what I'm going through. So I thought to myself, well, if Barbara asks me again, I'll just have to say that I'll try as much as I can. And if he sends me away, well, that's it. You know, there's nothing I can do about that. So the next day, sure enough, Barbara said the same. And so I offered my little piece. I said, yes, I'll try as much as I can, Barbara, or something, or I'll just try. And Barbara looked at me and he said, 100%, will you try 100%? And I said, yes. So I thought, yeah, I can do that. And it was very interesting because when I was recounting this last year up in Avatar's abode, Francis was, we were sitting around in a circle swapping yarns about, you know, what it was like before Barbara. And Francis roared laughing at this 100%. He said, you know, he shook his head and he said, oh, he's a cunning old devil or something like that, you know. But the one of the other things that... I'm sorry, all I can bore you with is my actual perspective of the way I saw Barbara, because I wasn't into this group thing, or we weren't reading Barbara books or anything like that. It was later on that I started doing that. But, you know, this is just giving you what Barbara was like to me as a child. The other things that Barbara was on about, which I noticed, and it was very interesting because other people didn't always notice these things. You know, some things strike some people and not others. But he was also on about loving him, what that meant, and purity, what purity meant. He was, I think, going in through this process. You know, historically we know what sort of stages Barbara went through. But he was going through this process of bringing Mara to the attention of women. And he said at this stage, this is the women's meeting with Barbara, he said that Mara was purity personified. And, you know, that's just words. But anyway, he got across this message that Mara was purity personified and what that meant. And what it does mean, of course, is total love for Barbara, pure and exclusive love for Barbara, which is a bit of an anomaly, because that pure and exclusive love for Barbara is in fact love for everything and everyone and the whole lot, because Barbara is everything. But he did get this idea across. And that's what I mean when I say that, you know, for me that second encounter was really just a kick in the tail, because it was very obvious to me that there was no way that I could ever measure up to that. And any illusions I'd had about being loving or being able to love or even do little things in obeying Barbara were just out of the question. I was just way, way off that. So that was very shattering at that age. And the only consolation, I think, was that I know that, I know that my mother had been through it before in her earlier encounters with Barbara. It was obvious to me that Ethel was going through much the same. It was also obvious to me that some of the other kids, like Craig and Jean, also were experiencing it in a similar way to the way I was. And as I said later on, you know, Bernard and I were just recently swapping notes about how we felt about it all, and in some ways it was very similar. Also, I noticed that even my older brother, Noel, was, for instance, Barbara, when he was doing the prasad bit, this was at the meeting the next day, he was throwing these lollies to everyone. They were quite big lollies. And he said that it was very important that we all catch it. We had to catch this lolly, you see. So Mum's got her story about, you know, she's a mug too and never catches anything, but she just put her hands out and it plopped in. And if you've seen any of those films of Barbie, you know how he'll throw 10 things at once and there's hands going everywhere, and some people, you know, just hands will sort of appear and the thing plops in. So Barbara is an expert at getting that prasad there if he wants it to be there. Well, anyway, I, of course, missed mine. So I felt dreadful about that again. I thought, oh, well, you know, I'm really hopeless. I mean, I can't even do a simple thing like catch a piece of prasad, and Barbara had said this was very important, so I'm just missing out all the way. But I was a little bit cheered when afterwards we all had to wait, the ones who'd dropped the prasad, and Barbara hauled us out in front, you know, and again, this is terrifying to me, but I think terrifying to most of us at that time. And so Barbara hauls us out, and I found to my surprise that there's Noel, my older brother, who's certainly no butterfingers, very quick and agile, and the last one you could imagine actually dropping a piece of prasad. So I thought, oh, that's not too bad then. Then there was Elsie. I think even Ina was there, weren't you? Were you? No, I think there was Ina and Elsie. So, you know, there's all the old Trojans, if you'll pardon the expression. Yeah. We're all there. Anyway, Barbara threw the prasad again, and this time we did all catch it. And again, it was years and years later that I suddenly realised that we were quite lucky. I mean, we got a lot more time with Barbara and a lot more personal attention. But at the time, of course, I didn't see it that way. I just thought, oh, you know, I'll fumble fingers again. There are other little stories, but I won't go on with that, because the major thing about it was that obedience for Barbara, obedience is one of the cornerstones of being a follower of Barbara, and that came through very clearly. One of the other cornerstones is loving Barbara, and that came through very clearly. And again, you know, he's always, with our family and with me, he's always harped on this, do you love me? And he's always tried to show us what that means. And then there was this other business of the purity, which he was describing through Mara. And then fourthly, there was this business of the prayer of repentance, which again was a fascinating little episode, because Barbara said that he was going to recite this prayer of repentance, and he insisted that Donkin do it. Dr. Donkin actually was one of the Mundali, but he very rarely appeared. He was sort of just there on the premises and we didn't see him. Anyway, Barbara sent off for Donkin. I don't know why, but I remember that, again, it was very, very power-charged at this time. And I think Donkin must have been a bit of a barometer or something for Barbara, because Donkin, who was certainly not the timid type, you might say, Donkin's voice tremored and trembled, and he really shook with the force of it. And anyway, he read out this prayer of repentance, and then Barbara said this bit about how he'd forgiven us our sins up to that point in time. And I don't know what the significance of that is, But anyway, it was pretty obvious that it was something very, very special just from the way Donkin behaved. The third time I saw Barbara, I warned you, the third time I saw Barbara was in 1964. At the end of 1964, Barbara was in total seclusion. I just got this urge that I wanted to go to India. I missed out going for the East-West service, East-West gathering, because Barbara had sent a message that we were only to come if it didn't interfere with our work or something.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. And it just so happened the first day of the East-West gathering was my first examination in second year at Melbourne Uni. Yes. And I felt that that was my work and that therefore I couldn't go. And I felt very, very sorry. This is the strange thing about Barbara. Although you feel, you know, he literally, the fear of God means a lot to me now. You hear all of this in the Bible. I think I know what that means. Mm. But although you have that feeling, you do anything to be with him, or at least I would. And I think we would do anything to be with Barbara. And so this was, to me, an opportunity to do the little bit of obedience that I thought maybe I could do. This was something I could do. I could do it willingly and happily and without too much regret, because as far as I was concerned, I was 100% obeying Barbara. So I was quite willing to do that. And so I missed out. And particularly as I'd realised from my experience with Barbara in 58 that I was an extremely greedy and cowardly type of person, I felt quite pleased about that. Anyway, I did miss out, and I don't know whether there's any connection, but what happened in 1964 is I had this wish to go to India, and I knew all about it being in total seclusion and all the rest, and nobody could go to India and see Barbara. But as I said, even though I was at this stage, I was 20, I still didn't understand Barbara. I thought I had this, you know, naive idea that I could go to India, and if okay, I couldn't see Barbara, but the two things were quite divorced. You know, that I'd just go to India and I'd just travel around, and that'd be that. And I certainly didn't expect to see Barbara. What I didn't realise is that if you are attached to Barbara, if you, I mean, if you have the connection with him, there's no way you can do that without his permission. But I learnt that through this experience in India. Anyway, I wrote to Francis, and Francis wrote me back the usual and said, no way, we're in total seclusion. You know, you would have no hope of seeing Barbara, so forget about that. So I did forget about that, but I still went on with this plan of going to India. So I went with the university students because we had to be back early because we were starting teaching the next year. I decided to go on my own with a friend. This friend knew nothing at all about Barbara. She was just a friend from uni. So anyway, we went in company with the other university students, but we were travelling separately. But we had the same travel arrangements as they, on the same ship. And we did pretty much the same. You know, the NUAUS scheme then was that you go to India. I think Indonesia was the only other country that had started up at this stage, and you either stayed with an Indian family or you actually were part of a project. Well, we couldn't be part of a project, so we did this staying with Indian families, except that I thought, oh, well, I know enough Barber people, you know, maybe we'd be able to do that. So we arrived in India, and Mum had written off, and Ina had written off too, on my behalf, just two people that they'd met. And one of the first people that came to see me was Arnavis. And Arnavis and I just clicked, you know, I think that Arnavis and I are actually very close, even though we have very little contact in the physical sense or even letter writing, et cetera. But Arnavis and I took to each other like, you know, duck to water, et cetera, that saying. And she was just going up to visit Barbara. She was going up for Mara's birthday. This is in December, of course. And she said that she'd mentioned that I was there and that I'd like to see Barbara and all this sort of thing. So I said, oh, yeah, not thinking ever that Barbara would say I could come. So I trundled off quite happily. And next thing we get a message from Katie Arani, who was still in Bombay, that Barbara had said that we could come, and this included my friend, Janice, who'd never had no contact with Barbara. Now, fortunately, because I knew that I'd be meeting a few Barbara people, I thought I'd better say something to Janice, so I warned her about these strange beliefs that I had. And Janice is a very nice person. You know, she looked at me as though I was off my head, but she was quite tolerant otherwise, you know. And this is what just one of the strange aberrations that I had. And she, anyway, she'd met Arnavis too, of course, and quite liked Arnavis and Katie, so that was okay. So it was arranged that we go up to Marizad, and Nariman and Arnavis's younger brother and Katie were to travel with us. Or we were to travel them, I beg your pardon. So we went up in their car. And then when we got to Ahmednagar, we stayed at Vilu's place for a while, and then we were taken out. Nariman and Arnavis went out to Marizad, but then they were staying there. They were living there for a few weeks, which they used to do every year. And so I went out in somebody else's car. I think it must have been Sarish's car and Janice. And we arrived at Marizad, and Francis came rushing out, and, you know, we had the embrace and all that. I was quite shocked by the conditions there. I mean, the conditions for Erich. Erich literally lived in a little packing case. It was quite an eye-opener to see just what life was like for the Mundaleer at Marizad. Anyway, my experience with Barbara at this time was, again, quite different. It wasn't awe and wonderment. It wasn't terror. That sort of subsided, although I was very wary of him. You know, I kept on waiting for this bolt from hell to come or something rather, and it didn't. But Barbara was, it's hard to describe what he was that time. It was obvious that he was very abstracted. Arnavis said later that it was just that he was in tremendous pain, and he wasn't quite there in the sense that he had been before. But then suddenly the old Barbara would come through and there'd be something that was very, very penetrating. But I certainly found him a lot softer and a lot gentler, and that's where I made my big mistake, in that I sometimes turned away from him. But I learned something out of that. I turned away at one stage and I was talking to Francis and exchanging with him. And then I noticed that Francis never took his eyes off Barbara, and nor did Erich. It didn't matter what they were doing. They could almost have their back to Barbara, and they knew exactly what he was doing. If he twitched, if, you know, there was a tiny flicker of the eyelid, they knew. And so that was interesting to see the way that they never took their eyes off Barbara. And I thought, oh, there's got to be a lesson in that. You know, I better sort of switch back on, or I might get this bolt from hell. So anyway, I did, but... Again, years later, a lot of it didn't make sense to me until I'd really sort of worked it through and got it out of my system. But what I did learn from that years later was this business about, first of all, Barbara said a couple of things to me which I think are just for me personally, and I'm quite happy to share them, but I don't think that they're meant for necessarily for other people. But again, he was back on this, you know, he said, "Do you love me?" And I said, yes, I do. And I meant it. You know, I really think that I did. And he looked at me and he said, "You should love me more." And it was obvious, you know, he was sort of peering. You talk about peering at someone's psyche. You know, it's sort of pushing the strands away. And Barbara looked at me and I could almost hear him thinking, well, that's not good enough yet, you know. But there was no condemnation with it. You know, you don't feel rotten, or I didn't feel sort of like the depths like I had in 1958. And what Barbara did that time was to show what loving him meant. And he used the example of Vilu, which was very interesting because he said that Vilu loves me, and I sent her down to Madras to represent me at such something. And I looked at Vilu and she was glowing. She was really shining, and she was... You know, they were just glowing at each other. And it was years later that I found that Vilu actually apparently wasn't convinced about Barbara. You know, I don't think she would have even described herself at that time as a Barbara follower. And I think now that was very important, that Barbara was telling her that she loved him and she was looking at him, and I could see that she did. Anyway, they had this sort of little glow session, and then at another instance, Barbara again showed this tremendous sense of humour that he had. Which, again, is hard to explain unless you've actually seen it. But he must find life a terrific joke sometimes, because one of the visitors was his brother, his younger brother, Artie Jr., and his Artie Jr.'s little girl, whose name I keep on forgetting, Shireen, little Shireen. And she was a precocious little eight-year-old. That's about the only way to describe her. She just looked, she was fantastic, Barbara's niece and all the rest. And anyway, she trots in, very importantly. This is after I'd had the personal interview with Barbara and we were all sitting around in the meeting hall. And she trots in and she sits herself down, very importantly. And Barbara says, Shireen, do you love me as much as I love you? And she looked at him, you know, she's a real little actress, this kid. Oh, she's a woman now. She looked at him and she, you could, it, almost this fatuous look on her face. She looked at him and she said, more. And Barbara and Erich and myself and Francis, and we just roared, you know. To us, this was terribly funny, you know. And Barbara was very tolerant about it, and he sort of, you know, patted her on the head and this sort of thing, you know. I don't think Shireen at that time quite got what the joke was, but anyway, it was very funny. But what I found later on was this business of what a connection with Barbara meant. Oh, sorry, before I forget, I was going to say there was one other thing that he said to me. He said that he just looked at me suddenly. This is after asking me, did I have anything to say to him, which I did, but I won't go into that. And then after that, he said, you should read God Speaks. It will answer all your questions. And I can remember laughing then. I can remember thinking to myself, but I haven't got any questions. You know, what's this mean? And I still don't know what it means. And yet it was obviously something that was very important, significant for me, but I don't know what. Except that I mentioned that just idly once to Francis Brabazon, and he looked quite astonished. Apparently, he hadn't heard that before. He hadn't heard Barbara actually say that, and he obviously didn't hear Barbara say it at that particular time. But he was quite astonished. He said, "Oh, that's what do you say? Oh, that's very significant, or something like that." But don't ask me what the significance is, because I don't know. I still don't know, and I'm still trying to work out. And I must say, I don't read God Speaks. After an invitation like that, I suppose you'd think that you would, but I have no wish yet to read God Speaks, and I don't believe in doing things until you really want to do it. So anyway, maybe in another 50 years, if I'm still around then, or in some other incarnation or something, I'll find out what the hell he meant. But at the moment, I don't understand it. Anyway, that was one thing. But what I did understand, what I did learn there, is this business of the connection with Barbara and what it means. And that's where I learnt, but again, years later, the significance of it finally dawned on me, because I must be a slow learner, the significance of this attentiveness of Barbara. He, at one stage during our interview, he said to me, what do you intend to do now? And so I said, oh, well, you know, Janice and I, we thought we'd go up to Delhi and we thought we'd go down to Madras and we thought we'd go here and we thought we'd go there. And Barbara was sitting there and the hands started going 10 to the dozen again. And he was obviously, he was quiet for a while and he was cogitating about this. And it suddenly struck me, you know, that I had to have Barbara's permission to do any of this. It had never occurred to me before that there was no way I could go around India unless Barbara said I could. And I thought, oh, here we go again. I'll have to turn around and go home. Fortunately, at this stage, I would have been quite happy to go home. And it's interesting that, you know, with this feeling of being very, very happy to go home, not wanting particularly to stay on it at all, Barbara then, as I said, after a pause of about a minute of all this twiddling and, you know, God knows what was going on, Barbara said, all right, you can stay. And again, I didn't know what that meant, but I realised later what it did mean. Barbara said I could stay, and then he teed up with Jal and a few other people that I should stay with a Barbara lover in Delhi. And I remember when the train pulled up there, which was an unscheduled visit, a stop for the train, I can remember noticing and thinking, gee, what a strange thing. Why am I noticing this place? You know, what am I sitting here looking at this? Anyway, I knew where we were, and I knew that this bloke was heading towards the cages because I'd been told they weren't far away. And I take it you know what the cages are. Oh, yeah. It's an area in Bombay which is a well-known prostitution area. It's an area where they take Westerners and beat them up and turf them out and bash them and rob them and all the rest. It's certainly not a very salubrious area in Bombay. Anyway, here we were just near the station, not far away. And so I said to Denise, I know where we are and I know where he's taking us. We've got to get out. So we there were quite a few people walking along the road. So we just opened up the door and jumped out of this taxi because it had slowed down far, you know, it was going only about 5 miles an hour or so. And we just jumped out. And then we were still left with the problem of how to get back because we were miles and miles and miles away from anywhere. So Janice and I hopped into this other taxi that was cruising past, and we thought, well, we'll have this conversation. We'll say in English, knowing that this bloke could speak English, what we'll do if he dares deviate from the way back, because I knew the way back along the main roads. Well, fortunately, this guy didn't. And we did get back to the hotel safely, but we were very, very lucky. And then we had a couple of other things, like one night when we got to Madras, we went to Delhi and that was okay. We then went down to Madras, and cholera was rife through southern India at this stage. So Westerners were not allowed to get off the train at Madras. We were sent on. Our next stop was to be Bangalore. We weren't allowed to get off there because of cholera. So finally we ended up at Mangalore. And the train pulled in at about 11:30 at night, and we knew that we had, of course, hadn't booked for this because we weren't expecting to get that far. And we knew that we couldn't walk the streets to get to our hotel. We knew that we couldn't get in a taxi, so that meant we just had to stay on the station. And so we tried to get accommodation in the station duck house, you know, which is above, and, of course, it was full up and there was no way. And finally, one of the guards, we thought, oh, well, you know, as I said, being naive little so-and-sos, we thought, oh, well, you know, this is it. What will we do? So we went up to one of the station fellows, and he said, look, he said, the only thing I can suggest to you, he agreed with us that we couldn't do any of those other things. He said, if you go into the first class ladies' waiting room, he said, bolt the doors and turn out the lights. And he said, and don't say a word. And it's very, very dangerous. Well, as I said, naive and stupid 21, we went into the first class waiting room. We bolted the doors, all right, but we decided to have a shower because we felt a bit sticky. We talked at the top of our voices for hours on end. We left all the lights on. We heard a lot of noise outside, but nothing happened. And the next morning, the porter there, he just couldn't believe it. He'd noticed that, you know, we had the lights on and did all the things that he told us not to do, and no one came near us. And anyway, so that was another thing. And then finally, back in Bombay, we got caught in a situation again inadvertently, just not our fault, not through our planning, where we had to walk through the streets of Bombay to get back to our hotel because we knew we couldn't get a taxi. The buses had all stopped, you know. There was just no other way. We either had to stay at the Taj Mahal Hotel or we had to walk back to the hotel. So we decided to walk back, and we walked along these streets. We walked along these streets that we knew, and they weren't particularly well lit because, of course, the power in India isn't anything like the power here. Everything is fairly subdued. We walked along these streets, and I can remember thinking to myself, gee, this is really strange. There's not a soul in sight. And that's almost unheard of in Bombay or any place in India. There's almost nowhere in India that you can go where there are not 100 million people walking with you. Anyway, we walked through these streets and we did not pass another soul until we got just near the hotel, and which was much more brightly lit. And, of course, it sunk in on me later, years later, that that was an extremely dangerous thing to do because we, in fact, walked through the dockside area of India. Now, I wouldn't walk through Port Melbourne at night for all the tea in China. But we walked through the dockside area because we thought, oh, yeah, that's where the ship came in, we know. So we walked through the docks of Bombay, which is an extremely dangerous area. And that's what I mean when I think what happened with Baba was that he took responsibility for us. And no wonder the fingers were twiddling all over the place, because he must have known what a couple of pigeons, you know, were being let loose in his country, and that he really would have to look after us, which he did. And so we were very, very lucky to come through that unscathed, but we did. That's the other impression that third impression that I carried back of Baba was his intense attentiveness to you as a person and to your own needs. And as I said, it's sometimes expressed in a form that you don't like a kick in the tail. But he, whatever it is, he is very, very attentive. That's all.